and gentlemen, welcome back to Pop Culture Ninja. I'm Nathan, here with Nathan. Nathan, what's going on, man?
Not too much. We are back with our weekly review.
Yeah, and joining us, special guest, your sister Rachel. Rachel, yeah, how you doing? Yeah,
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Doing well.
Returning guest.
That's right. Yeah,
it's good to be back.
Yeah, it's good to have you back on. Excited about this one because we're going to be got a few things to review here tonight, Nathan. We're going to be talking about the beer fest that we went to this past weekend.
Yes, over the Honey Go.
And then you've got Movie Event Horizon.
Not Event Horizon.
Oh, right.
Yeah. That's taking me back. Event Horizon was a horror movie about like the spaceship that disappeared
exactly
into a porthole.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah, now those images are back in my head. No. Deepwater Horizon, dealing with a certain kind of inferno, but not that inferno.
That's right.
And we also have a review for Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, the movie.
That's right.
Rachel and I saw. We're going to have a podcast coming up very shortly next week that we'll be going over the book.
Yeah.
And Rachel's also read the sequel, so she'll join us again for that and talk about those. But this will be a review of the movie.
Yep.
And then
I'm going to review Yu-Gi-Oh! The card game. Just let folks kind of know about it if they're not familiar with it. And if you are, you either love it or hate it. So let's.
And if you don't know much about it, you are indifferent.
That's right. Let's go ahead and dive right in. Let's start with the beer fest, since that happened this past Sunday. It was over at Honey Go Wine and Spirits. Took over that entire side parking lot next to the Wise. And, I don't know what your thoughts were, Nathan, but I thought they did a great job with it. Thank you, Bernie Hoffman, for offering up your store and hosting that. Really appreciate you doing that every year. And then for Alex, the store manager, who kind of coordinated everything, brought it together.
He did a really good job with that.
He did. You know, there was 27 different breweries there, I believe.
I was impressed. I had not been in previous years, and I saw the list, obviously, but I was impressed with how much they had in that small space. And it was a very nice enclosed space.
Yeah.
I've been to other beer festivals where they'd have probably maybe 5 or 6 more than what you just mentioned, 30, spread over a much larger space where you're just walking back and forth. This was a really nice, almost like kind of community thing, because it's that one parking lot, so it's all it basically forms like an open rectangle.
Yeah.
And all the beers go down one side and back, and you had the food cart, the gypsy food truck at the end, and you had Lib's Grill was giving away this delicious bread and cheese dip.
Man.
Yeah. And you could kind of just keep refilling.
Yeah.
I think between Greg and I, we ate a loaf of bread and a vat of cheese dip.
That's right.
I won't reveal which one was which one consumed more. But
that's right. And it was great. You know, there was a live band there, and the sound was really good. It wasn't, blowing your eardrums away loud, but it wasn't, so soft that you could barely hear it if you were at the other end of the parking lot. Great volume for the venue that it was at. And, the other thing to mention, too, is just how family-friendly it was, really. Obviously, kids aren't there drinking, but, there were a lot of families there with their children and, spouses just hanging out and enjoying.
Yeah. And there were a few children there. Again, like you said, they weren't drinking, but it was definitely a very laid-back event. There was no one walking around belligerently drunk or anything.
Nice.
I will mention, I probably shouldn't mention which brewery it was, but one of the breweries there, everyone had a couple people behind the tables running the brews. And at one point, Greg's like, hey, the guys over there aren't feeling any pain. And I look over, the one guy's like river dancing behind the thing. And you know what's funny is Greg and I look back to go get something else from that particular table. They were gone, and there were other people coming. I was like, oh, they must have had to take a break. I think they were over on the grassy knoll there, passed out. But
yeah,
it was funny. They were gone. I never saw those two guys come back.
I know. And the weather, it was great weather. It was a little overcast, but it was cool but not too cold. I mean, very comfortable in a longer sleeve shirt. And
which, for here, it had been very warm up until that point. So I think, it was great weather. There were a lot of good beers there.
Yep.
A couple things that stood out to me. There was a tent, I think, what was it? Was it white something? I can't think
the
of
the one at
the very end
the food truck,
which turned out to be hard seltzer water, which is basically it tastes exactly how that sounds. So if you actually think that sounds good, maybe you'll enjoy it, but
if you don't,
I couldn't quite get the point of it. And I'm a fan of seltzer water, actually, recently. fan of seltzer water. I drink it now instead of soda, but this was not my thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah, I don't think it would be mine.
I got to say, you know, for me, I was there. The event went from 12 to 4. So, you know, you've got 4 hours of unlimited drinking while you're there.
And,
you
with
know,
6 ounce yeah, sampling six glass. Ounce
sampling glass. I mean, you were even saying, Nathan, offline that, you know, toward the end of it, you were just asking for half pours. You weren't even getting the full.
Because I was at the point where I was just wanting to taste everything. Yeah. They had not everything, but as much as I could. And I was like, at this point, I, you know, I'm standing around, Gregor's sitting there talking. It's like, I just want enough to taste.
Yeah.
And that was nice because they would do that. They would pour. So it wasn't like you had to drink every single. And if you got something you didn't like, you just pour it out and get rid of it. It was, I thought it was a really nice selection of different beers and breweries. I mean, they had Sam Adams there and they were debuting some stuff. And they had Flying Dog was there.
Yep.
And
Bell's Brewery.
Bell's Brewery had a really good Oktoberfest there that was really good. I really liked the stuff that Evolution brought.
I didn't actually get to Evolution.
They had, I think, I'm trying to pronounce this correctly, because they always come up with these crazy names, like the Jack-O-Lantern or whatever, where they took their 140 beer, and basically the guy there told me that they took an entire pumpkin and just stuffed it down into the vat, and you could tell. It was a super good pumpkin ale. And their pineapple was really good, too. So those are two.
I changed my mind. I did. I tried the pineapple one. You're right. That was good because they took their Lot 3, which is their IPA, not their heavier IPA, but their lighter IPA, and infused pineapple with it. And that was tasty.
I think it seemed to be the consensus of everybody that was there talking, our little group, later in the afternoon, that probably one of the best ones was the Brooklyn's Oktoberfest. Mm. It was very, very good. Probably had the best flavor. Long Trail had some. I'm trying to remember. They had one there that was a Pilsner that I really liked.
Yeah.
Flying Dog had some strange. It was peach, but it had a like almost hot peppery underneath to it, which I was not really getting into. Particularly, you're sitting out there, and after a few beers, it's like, I don't know that the hot pepper peach.
Yeah.
Was my kind of thing. It was like almost like a salsa beer.
Yeah.
If I could say such a thing.
Sure.
I really liked the fact that they had Charm City Meadworks there.
Yes.
That was something I didn't expect. And they had two meads. One of them was a pumpkin spice mead.
Yep.
Delicious. Now, Rachel, have you had mead before?
Yes, I have.
Do you like it? Do you not like it?
My experiences with mead have been that they tend to be a little thick, a little sweet, and rather syrupy. And so I'm not usually a fan.
And I think that that's probably most people's experience with it. Yep. A little thick, a little syrupy. And that's kind of what mead is, particularly you have that medieval style.
Sure.
And I kind of like it for that. But what was, Nathan, correct me if I'm wrong here, for the Charm City mead, I didn't think either one of those were sticky sweet, heavy, or thick.
No.
Like, that was the thing that was impressive. It wasn't like beer.
I'm trying to think if I'd had any of those. I think I've seen them at Honey Go. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I've actually
bought them
because I saw mead, I thought syrup, and I was like, gross.
No, this almost...
Yeah, the Charm City stuff is nicer because it almost feels... I mean, you're clearly drinking mead, which is honey, but it almost feels like a cider.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It's very similar to a cider. I think, you know, the Charm City mead, and this is maybe a good jumping off point for something you want to talk about, Rachel, to me is a little bit similar to some of Angry Orchard's, not their regular ciders, but their more specialty ciders like Iceman.
Yeah.
And Rachel, you were just talking about one, some of their ones like the Walden Hollow.
Walden Hollow, yeah. That's their one. That's their new one this year.
And I haven't had that one, but I had that one. I had the other one, that the Muse.
Yeah.
So to me, some of the Charm City stuff was a little closer to that than the meads that I previously
had.
Okay.
It
definitely
made
me want to... They were handing out some little like coupons where it was like $5 off going down to the brewery and going around and checking it out. And I actually wouldn't mind going down there and seeing what they're doing because I thought their stuff was very good.
Yeah.
That was probably the big surprise for me.
I will give them a try.
Yeah. Yeah. They are good. And so, you know, we're going to go ahead and just kind of wrap up our little segment. For me, I agree with you, Nathan. I think that pumpkin spice mead was one of the breakout ones for me that was really good. I was there from 12 to 2, so I ended up leaving early, didn't try as much stuff. But that one, and then the Rebel IPA grapefruit from Sam Adams
was
another just breakthrough one for me that I wasn't expecting much from both of them, and both of them met or blew away my expectations.
Right, and it was a grapefruit beer.
Yeah.
It was not like your kind of the level of a shandy. Because UFOs, I've mentioned this before, Harpoon's like version of the grapefruit is probably my favorite, but that is a shandy. This was not, and it still had a really strong, good grapefruit flavor.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So for me, you know, I don't know that there's much that I would say, hey, this is what I think you should do to improve upon what's going on. I mean, the event is just, it's relaxed and laid back enough that you just kind of go in, you do your thing. You know, you're expected to, you know, kind of take responsibility for, you know, how much you're drinking and if you're driving and all that. And
yeah, it's hard because even some of the things that might initially seem like kind of a weakness, like the fact that they only had the one food truck, so you had that one choice, it's not actually accurate because you actually had your pick of all the restaurants that are literally right there. And that's one thing that's usually not true of a festival. You usually can't go over and get food. So I went over and got food from, after imbibing all that bread, I went over and got food from R&R Takira right there, which is one of the best. And that Honeygo Shopping Center is a fantastic place for food. You've got great Indian food, great Chinese food, great Mexican food right there, great Subway.
Yeah.
But that too. And then the fact, like, the bathroom situation was a little dicey, but again, Greg, at one point, he just went into Weiss.
Yeah.
And, you know, the people were starting to figure it out. He's like, I think they're getting it because there's a line in Weiss now to use the bathroom. But it's a very easy location to get to.
Yep.
A very nice setup.
Plenty of parking in the area, too. I mean, you know, by the time I came, I could have parked in the actual Weiss parking lot, but just decided, you know what, I'm just going to go in the back because not a lot of people are going to be back there. And even when I left, again, we're talking about in the middle of the fest, there was still plenty of parking in the back.
Yeah. As a variety kind of person, I mean, I'm always someone who likes to see just a little bit more variety. Not variety of beers, but it might have been nice to see a couple other things. But this is what they were specializing in, specializing in beer. But it would have been nice to maybe have like a couple of different, you know, liquors or whiskeys or something like that. Again, having the mead there was a kind of nice thing. Maybe I would have traded out the seltzer tent for maybe a couple other things like that. But overall, particularly if you're a beer fan, it was pretty good.
Yeah. And so this is, you know, this is something, people, that you can expect that we are going to promote next year. Again, we gave away two tickets. Unfortunately, one of the people that we gave away to, he had to cancel last minute. He'd been up for the past 26 hours working.
Yeah, but Adam Block did come and he said he had a great time. I didn't, unfortunately, didn't get to touch base with him when he was there, but I saw he posted on Facebook on our page that he had gone.
So. Yeah, and it really is, you know, great. And I think next year what we're going to try to do is actually set up a little table of our own, and we'll be doing some recording.
We're making jail beer in our socks. Yeah, no,
I definitely want to go next year. I couldn't make it this year because I was working.
Well, see, the only thing though is because you're not that much of a beer fan. It's all really beer.
Right.
That's the one thing where if there were just a couple other booths or something, or you know, but who knows? In the future, they might expand because it looked like it was pretty well expanded from what they did this time.
Yeah. So Rachel, kind of segueing into that, you said you tried the Angry Orchard Walden. Tell us a little bit about that, how you enjoyed it or didn't enjoy it, whichever it may be.
The Walden Hollow. I just tried that this past weekend, and whereas I liked it, I don't know that I would buy it again. And I'm a big Angry Orchard fan. It's reminiscent. I recently drank a cider that tasted like straight apple cider vinegar.
Was that?
It was a local cidery.
We were excited for it, and it didn't pan out.
It had like ginger and stuff in it. I can't remember the name of it at the moment, but the Walden Hollow was nowhere near that tart and that sour. But it is a tart cider. It's a more sour cider, a drier one for sure. Not as sweet as typical Angry Orchard. And I did try it with a friend. She was like, it's okay. My impression was that she didn't really like it. Mm. Like I said, I couldn't sit there and keep drinking it because it is more tart, has more like notes of vinegar than like what you think of when you think Angry Orchard cider. Not bad, but it's not particularly my style, just because of the acidity and the tartness. We also tried another one, Crispin cider, and it's one of their artisan ones called The Saint, which is sort of smoothed out with maple syrup quality. But don't let that throw you off because it's not thick. It's not sweet.
Right.
You actually can't, it doesn't taste like maple. It just smooths out the tartness of the apple.
Okay.
And it, It's really, really, I thought it was really, really good. It does have a higher alcohol content of 6.9. So that's the Crispin, the Saint. It's served in a bigger bottle. I can't remember exactly how many ounces.
Probably 16 ounce.
Yeah, I think that's what the Crispin like.
Something like that,
we had
that,
the pear one, so we thought that was decent. And,
I split it between a friend of, with my same friend that I tried the other cider with. We split it, and we were both like a little giggly at the end. And we're like, this is just a cider. We saw it is a 6.9. But that's a good one. I would recommend that one. The Walden Hollow, if people like the more tart vinegar quality, then go for that one. But it's not what you typically think of when you think Angry Orchard, I would say.
Okay. Fair enough. Very cool. So, yeah, next moving on, like we said, you know, we've got a game review, Yu-Gi-Oh! Yu-Gi-Oh! Is a lot of people who are familiar with it will probably think of it and remember it as a childhood game. I actually didn't get into it.
As a Pokemon rip-off?
Well, actually, what's interesting is they both came out fairly close to one another.
That late 90s?
Yeah. Yeah, so... They're actually fairly close. Actually, the way a lot of people usually view them is when you're younger, Pokemon is the card game that you typically will get into. It's a little bit easier. The rules are simple.
Drug.
That's right, exactly. Yu-Gi-Oh! Is kind of the mid-level game, and then Magic.
And you move right into tarot cards.
That's right. That's right. You get the Jack or the Joker or whatever it is. I actually got into Yu-Gi-Oh! Is probably about 3 years ago. A friend of mine who plays games. He had done it with his daughters. They had gone to tournaments. So there were a lot of friends their age who were still playing, and he wanted to know if I wanted to get into it. And I'm into games and things like that. So I said, sure. And, you know, I started off with one deck, and now I have thousands of cards. So it got a little addicting for me. It's a fun game, though. It's a game where...
Do you go to tournaments?
I do not.
I'd like you to get some video footage of you just, like, taking out, like, 6 or 7 year olds.
That's right. I use my MST.
Pay up.
No, I actually have not done any tournaments at this point. It's just for fun. He and I will get together, and usually with several other people, and we'll do mini tournaments with one another. But it's, you know, it's a fun deck building game. You build cards. You look for cards that you can incorporate into your decks. I have two decks that I consider my own decks. One of them is a machine deck, and it just revolves around, like it says, machines. And the other one is a specialty deck called an Egyptian God card deck. And, you know, it's just fun. Take him. He's got a whole ladder of decks that I'll go in and play up against if he and I are just playing, or other people will bring their specialty decks that they've played or that they've built and play against them. So
the real question is, when do we get the phone app?
The phone, yeah.
The Yu-Gi-Oh! Phone app.
What's interesting is I was actually looking at something online where they are trying to develop, again, that augmented reality thing where you have your phone, basically, or your iPad or whatever, looking at whatever the cards are. And so you're playing the game, and it's virtually, you know, bringing the monsters up and battling them. So honestly, I could see that coming in as like a PlayStation VR or, you know, some kind of VR technology where that soon could be a reality.
This is all really a waste. I just want the They Live app where you can hold it up and see the alien skeleton heads on everybody. I knew it! My boss is an invader!
That's great. So yeah, I mean, you know, Yu-Gi-Oh! It can be an expensive hobby. It can also be fairly inexpensive. You can get a starter deck for like $10 and just kind of go out and play and have fun.
What age would you recommend?
Well, I mean, I'm, you know...
We don't have to deal with that part.
34.
Like a beginning age.
Yeah, starting out, I mean, I recommend someone, in, you know, that 12 to 13 range starting, getting into it. If they've played Pokemon and understand kind of the rules of Pokemon and they've done that for a little while, maybe a little earlier. But I think 12 to 13, you begin to understand the strategy. There is strategy. There is combos that come in. Different than Pokemon, when it's your turn, you're playing everything on your turn, and you're not doing anything on your opponent's turn. Where in Yu-Gi-Oh, if you set certain cards, you're waiting for their turn in order to activate and play them. So there is, you know, reverse strategy of when this person goes, now I'm going to activate and use this. that comes into play. So I think that 12 to 13 range is a good starting point for that.
Cool.
So, and Nathan, you've got a movie that you were going to review?
Yeah. Like I said, we have a couple movies. It's nice to be back in the movie reviewing game of brand new movies come out. We kind of fell behind the times there. So this weekend, we've got also coming out this week our fall movie preview. And actually, the two movies that we're talking about tonight kind of fall outside that because they were coming out this week and we knew we were talking about them. But we are definitely getting into that point in time. We're getting the fall movies. Some of them have big blockbuster elements to them, but they're also, we're gearing up towards the Oscars, so their movies are a little bit more serious, and we kind of jokingly said this is kind of the time a more adult fare comes out. Sure. That's not exactly what we have this week, but we have two movies. The more adult of the two is a movie called Deepwater Horizon, which has nothing to do with spaceships going to hell.
That's right.
But it actually deals with, in 2010, you may remember when off of the Gulf Coast, the oil rig that basically exploded, and we had the biggest oil leak they'd ever had. And I remember the footage of that, if you remember the footage of this thing just burning out there in the night. Yep. A very horrifying and terrifying thing. And 11 people died in the process of dealing with that. So Deepwater Horizon is that story, and you figure that that's a really... there is a compelling movie to be made out of that. Mm-hmm. The question, and the trailers play up the action elements or the sort of disaster elements of it. And every time I see previews for these things now, Deepwater Horizon and the movie last year, The Finest Hours.
Yes.
When I saw the trailers in the theater, I got excited. I'm like, it's a giant monster movie. And then disappointed. I mean, Deepwater Horizon even had the little girl talking about dinosaurs. And then Mark Wahlberg goes on to explain, well, you know, they're fossils, honey, and that's what I'm digging up. And it's like, oh, well, there isn't really going to be a giant dinosaur.
Right.
That's my own hang-up. There was never an expectation in this movie to have aquatic dinosaurs, but maybe it should have.
Pacific Rim 2.
Pacific Rim 2, right. Even when they get the aquatic dinosaurs, I'm not happy. So Deepwater Horizon is directed by Peter Berg. Peter Berg has made a lot of movies dealing with kind of the man of action. The most recent one would have been Lone Survivor with Mark Wahlberg. He also did Battleship.
Yes.
Now, it's fair to say that Deepwater Horizon is much more similar to Lone Survivor.
Yeah, oh, I thought you were going to say Battleship.
No. Lone Survivor than Battleship. It may take place on the water, but that's about where the similarities end.
Right.
And you have Mark Wahlberg and Kurt Russell are leading up the cast, and they are the two main crew members that the movie deals with, although there are others, a small group of people dealing with this accident. And of course, it kind of shows that perspective where you've got the heads of the company that want to keep drilling regardless of safety and things like that. And we have John Malkovich, of course, is the sort of almost mustache-twirling bad guy. He has a Cajun accent in this, so he's playing that up. But it's not over the top. We're not talking about a Michael Bay-level movie here. Again, Peter Berg has done movies like The Kingdom and Lone Survivor.
Yeah.
And several different movies where he's really good technically at setting these things up and giving you a good sense of space and what's happening in action scenes, but he's also good at handling character development and things like that with movies. So this movie is an action-oriented movie. It's very harrowing at points. Like, when things start to go down, you have this real sense of chaos. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember movies like Black Hawk Down and stuff, but Ridley Scott is trying to give you this idea of how hectic everything is. Mm-hmm. But he almost makes it too hectic to the point where watching Black Hawk Down, there is a point where I almost disengage because I've lost track of who's where and what's going on. And I can't tell whether, am I looking at Orlando Bloom here or Ewan McGregor, you know, because there's so much chaos. And this movie has that chaos, but he keeps it well contained because we're kind of following the characters and we're able to get a sense of where the characters are on the oil rig. When the action kicks in, it's pretty intense. Mm. I'd say the first half of the movie is almost a little clunky because it feels like they're just trying to give you all the details.
Sure.
They're like, we know you don't know, you saw this on the news, but this is the details of how it all went down. You know, that's always a hard part of movies. You remember the Titanic movie where they stopped to show you the computer generation of, well, here's what's going to happen. So the Titanic sinks. In a way, that was brilliant because later when the Titanic started going down, you were never in doubt of what was happening.
Right.
You knew that while you were watching people run, the bulkheads are filling up. Cameron has for all his other flaws, he has a really good handle on kind of how to couch that stuff.
Yeah.
Berg didn't really know what to do, so he just kind of throws some of it out there. He tries a little bit of that, but the movie's well acted. I mean, I'm not the biggest Mark Wahlberg fan, but he is a pretty good as that kind of blue collar working class guy. Kurt Russell did that very well for many years too, in addition to many other things.
Right.
But also blue collar buffoons.
I don't know when I've seen Kurt Russell last.
Brussels, well, I last saw him in a movie called Bone Tomahawk last October, where he played a, you know, kind of gunslinger type. He was in The Hateful Eight, too.
Yeah.
He pops up, but he was good here. He kind of goes back to that kind of square-jawed, sort of nose-nonsense. Mm-hmm. He's now playing that veteran sort of character.
Right.
And it's well-acted. It's a good action movie. It didn't blow my mind. Mm-hmm. I didn't really expect it to. I think if you go into this movie and you see the trailers and you're intrigued by it, I think you're going to get the movie you expect.
Sure.
It wasn't a lot more than that, and that kind of disappointed me a little bit, because watching it, I'm like, wow, I didn't quite feel the horror, the terror, and even some of the adrenaline in all the places. It was an effective action movie.
Right.
In some ways, it was a beefed-up TV movie,
okay,
if you will. But Berg does a great job directing it. If you're looking for something, this is probably the flip side to the movie Sully, which is a movie where, you know, people
right.
pulled off something great and everything kind of went right.
Right.
This is what happens when people don't plan and things go wrong. And then you've got guys trying to stand
clean
up in the face
mess,
of that.
Yeah.
So I think it's an effective movie. There are so many contrived action movies out there that I think people are going to see this. They're going to engage with some of the characters and they're going to engage with some of the action. It's a worthwhile movie to see.
Okay. Now, let me ask you a couple questions. First, do you think anything seeing this movie in IMAX or 3D would have enhanced the experience or taken away from it?
IMAX maybe, 3D. I thankfully did not see it in 3D.
Okay.
I think with 3D, it would just be overwhelming because of the nature of this. I mean, smoke, fire, and everything everywhere. This movie is already so visually hectic at points
mm-hmm.
that you're fighting to kind of stay with it. But
okay.
that's kind of, you're in the same places the characters,
right?
But I would say that 3D would have probably just
thrown it over the edge.
Yeah.
Okay. So maybe an IMAX setting though would have.
IMAX, you're going to get the big, grander sense of things,
okay.
And Berg again is good at capturing kind of visceral scenes.
Mm-hmm.
So IMAX usually always enhances that sort
right.
of thing
most of the time. And so the last question that I have would be, you know, clearly we talk about you know, parents having different standards for their children and having, you know, that discretion at their fingertips. But what would be an age that you would recommend?
This would maybe be a 13-year-old. I say that partly because I don't think a lot of people are going to be interested in it beyond
mm-hmm.
that. If you can grasp, though, what's going on here, you grasp a sense of heroism, and you have characters working together and having this kind of professional relationship where they're also trying to take care of each other, there's a lot of positive in that. So
mm-hmm.
we're not talking about grueling, mindless action where people are destroyed. We're
right.
talking about an adventure sort of movie that doesn't overplay any of its more harsh elements.
Okay, fair enough. Rachel, were there any thoughts or questions you had for Nathan about the movie?
I actually just heard about it tonight before the
okay.
thing. So I've been a little like under the rock lately. So.
Fair enough.
Well, I've like again, I thought it was a monster movie for the first
right.
the first few trailers.
They're
I saw.
Going yeah. down.
Deep water.
That's
event
right.
horizon.
but a movie that you do have experience with that you and Nathan are going to talk about, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar
mm-hmm.
Children. So go ahead and take us away on that one.
Yeah, so we went out, we saw it last week. It seems to be the one that's being touted as the big winner this weekend. It's the big
mm-hmm.
fantasy young adult movie based off of the book that we have put up on our Facebook. And
which we're going to review next week. We'll
review next week, and we'll also have, we're going to probably do that in two segments. We'll have a review and discussion of it, and then we'll have like the follow-up with feedback, and that's
sure.
why we'll do the book club elements of it. So the movie, because of that, I had read it because we picked the book. And Rachel, you read it too because of that.
Yes.
And so I was excited because of that. I've also not been a huge fan of everything that Tim Burton has done probably recently, last
mm-hmm.
five or six movies. Frankenweenie aside, I just think that a lot of his movies, they just don't have the same quirky sense of character that his earlier stuff did. I still
sure.
love things like Nightmare Before Christmas. I know we're going to go see it at the BSO performing live with the movie soon. Still excited to see that. Edward Scissorhands and Ed Wood
right.
and Sleepy Hollow. Love those movies. But I just haven't loved what he's done lately. So I walked in this trepidatious but interested because the book, I liked the book.
Mm-hmm.
I also thought the book set itself up very well to be a movie,
mm-hmm.
you know, in some ways, maybe to the detriment of being a book.
Right.
But Rachel, what do you think's going into it? Just, you know, before as we were walking into it.
So I definitely had some doubts just for a few things when I was approaching it, but I was excited for it because I read all three books and I enjoyed them, the trilogy. It's actually a trilogy. And the first book's actually my favorite of the three. And I remember as I was reading it, maybe because, you know, Ransom Riggs was a film student and everything, maybe because it does play out the book a little bit like a movie. It has pictures and stuff incorporated. I remember when I was reading it, I thought, man, this would be a fantastic book to see brought to life, to see on film. So I was really excited for that. I am a Tim Burton fan, not to say that I like everything that he's done. I like his ability at times to capture like things visually and kind of put you in an atmosphere. So with that hope from Tim Burton, even though he hasn't always pulled that off, with this book, I was like, oh, this is going to be great. Like I really am excited for the idea of a movie that can put me in the atmosphere of this book. I really like the characters. I'm ready to see this done on film. And the first preview that I saw threw me off because anyone who's read the book knows there's a major change up in the characters. And I don't know if I'll get into all that right now. But
I think it's safe to say that because that's almost superficial. Like,
okay.
Someone who's not read the book won't know this difference. Yeah. But it's...
There's a lot of changes. I mean, if for someone who has read the book, there's a lot of changes. The book, the movie kind of takes on its own story by many regards. But Emma Bloom is one of the main characters, and she has the ability to conjure fire in her hands. And there's another character, Olive, who has the ability to manipulate air. She kind of floats and levitates. In the movie, he switches them around. Or the screenwriter at least switches them around. So Emma is now has the ability to control air and is the levitator. And Olive, who's kind of in the movie relegated to a pointless kind of stand-in, doesn't really do much, unlike the book, she is the one who has the ability to ignite fire with her hands. And so I noticed that when I was watching the previews, and Emma's one of my favorite characters, so I was like, ooh, I don't know how that's going to go. But visually, he seemed to, visually he seemed to kind of capture the atmosphere and the tone of the book. And so I was like, well, I can deal with some of these changes. He might still pull this off because it looks, when the scene's in the houses and you see Miss Peregrine, like, go up into the Falcon. And I was like, he might actually at least get the gut of it a little bit.
And after watching the movie...
I was extremely disappointed to almost a point of like being very irritated with
it. We almost became those grumpy critics that snipe the movie while it's on.
I think I made a couple comments and the lady in front of me turned around, glared at me, and then shook her head for about 30 seconds. And I can't remember what
I said.
I
like to imagine she was shaking her head at Tim Burton.
To ignite that. I don't know. Maybe she was just like a hardcore like... I don't know, into the books.
Burton and
just
Knight.
Was
I think
she was going to like anything dealing with the books. But I actually loved the books, and as someone who loved the book, I found the movie pretty just... I could think of a lot of words. I'm going to stick with disappointing.
That's probably good. It is a family podcast.
Let me ask you guys this real quick. So separating the book from the movie...
we talked about that, actually.
Well, but no, just as a movie... would this be a movie that if you could just say, hey, you know, I was okay with the movie?
I think I'll just comment real quick. I think I actually tried to do that because I knew some of the changes from the preview. I recognized the changes with the characters, and so I was like, well, let me step back, let the screenwriter do their own thing. And Tim Burton have his own way with it. And I'm just going to try to enjoy this as a movie. So I kind of went in with that attitude. Not that you can ever perfectly do that.
Right.
So I was tracking with him for probably the first half of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But in my opinion, the movie's kind of divided up into two different things. There's the beginning half, which is okay. He's got the house. You're kind of picking up the idea of the stories. And then somewhere in the midway point, it literally just drops off, takes on a whole nother, like,
dimension,
a whole nother tone, a whole nother speed, and it just goes, it's like tracking, and then it's just all the way off the charts. And in that place of being all the way off the chart is just real, like, stupidity, just dumb stuff. It's like just slapstick. not to be like condescending, but something like you would watch on Nickelodeon, like in the afternoon or something, like real slapsticky, just trying to get some laughs. And sometimes the stuff is stuff that, you know, even without having read the book, you know, some of the stuff is supposed to be darker or creepier, and it's just like slapstick. Mm-hmm. And it roller coasters into this just ridiculous thing, and it's almost like it just I'll swear it feels like a two-part movie, where you have the first part, which is like, yeah, I can get this, I get behind this, it's kind of cool and visually awesome, and then it just goes off.
You get a feeling that at some point Tim Burton excused himself to take a bathroom break and he never came back to the set.
Yes,
and they just kept
does.
Filming the movie.
That's
without
perfect
him. No, I think Rachel's right, and here's the thing with this movie. I usually, with these young adult stories, if I haven't read the book already, I usually don't, because I want to experience the movie for what it is. I think that certainly Rachel and I were more disappointed by this movie because we had read the book, but I think that that disappointment comes in because had we watched this movie without the books, we would have been very disappointed by it, but we would have sat there and we would have looked at it and said, well, you know what? Maybe they didn't have a good story to work with. Mm. And the problem is here, in every way that this movie goes off the rails, it had a perfectly good, viable decision sitting right there in the book that Ransom Riggs wrote. And that is very infuriating, because you sit there and you look at, they thought they knew better. But usually, even in a case like that, where you see a movie make a change that maybe is artistic, if I feel like they've put their heart into doing it, even if it doesn't work, I can feel like, okay, you boldly took a choice, and you went that direction. We see that in movies all the time,
right,
that are based off books. And sometimes I actually enjoy that, and I say, okay, you know what? They went a different direction from the book, and some things made it work, and maybe if they didn't, they put themselves out there. This movie, I think, if you were watching it without the idea that it was even written from a book, you would have just gotten the impression that Tim Burton sat there and cobbled pieces together from various fantasy works over the years.
Disjointed.
And you would grab a little X-Men, grab a little Harry Potter, grab a little bit of time travel, mix it all together, and you'd get this sort of hodgepodge mishmash. I will, like Rachel said at the beginning, originally I was like, okay, I'm expecting, I was probably even a little less optimistic in terms of, I knew Tim Burton was going to try to make this his thing. And I actually was kind of hoping for that, because I don't think Tim Burton has really pushed his own vision to the forefront in a movie in quite a while. So when this movie begins and we get some of the Burton's take on some of the classic images here. So to back up very briefly, the story does involve a young boy who has listened to his grandfather talk for years about this school for children that he was sent to as a kid. And he was sent there to protect him from monsters. But when he learns over time that his grandfather, we're talking during World War II, and he was sent away because there were monsters. And, of course, we realize, or we think we know, that what he's referring to is the Holocaust.
Nazi, right? Nazis,
and, and not real monsters, which are these things called
Holocaust.
In the book they refer, or the movie they refer to them as Hollows or something like that. They even simplify that a little bit. So you have some of these creepy scenes, particularly when his grandfather's home in Florida, when they're there originally, some of those scenes where there are creatures in the shadows, that kind of stuff gets very Tim Burton-y when he first finds the house where the children reside, and the children who all have that kind of Burton-esque, freakish outsiderness to them.
Right.
What's wild is that he never establishes any of them as characters. They all sort of remain two-dimensional. We talk about the 3D. I'll just mention up front, some of the 3D was actually kind of nice in this movie. The way it gave some layers to it. And he has a couple really nice Burton quirky moments. When the time you first see the girl lift into the air and he tie her to the rope, that has a real kind of sense of losing gravity and losing yourself and floating up. And I like that. And there's even a point where one of the characters' abilities to bring inanimate things to life. And he brings these little creatures to life, stop motion style. And it was very Tim Burton-y, watching the two little creatures battle each other, which almost reminds you of the chess game in Star Wars. Those little touches were nice. And I'm thinking, okay, if we can get these touches and move them through the story, that's fine. But eventually, he really does just fall into an almost purely generic story. Midway through, it starts to feel like X-Men Home Alone or something. And not in a good way. Like Rachel's comparison to Nickelodeon, there's points where it feels like a sci-fi original. There's a point late in the game where there it looks like an army of Slendermen are fighting an army of skeletons, and I'm thinking this should be great, but it isn't. The sense of menace, the sense of the magical elements in the book are almost flattened out. And the scariness of what's happening is reduced to some goofy, pseudo-gory tidbits. I mean, something... the bit of what happens to the children, what the Hallowgast do to the children, is absolutely ridiculous in the movie.
Something you don't get into as much in the first book, but in the second book, you have these children basically going up against this, like, evil army, basically. And one of the things that I appreciated about it is while they're children, they're actually, like, advanced children because they're peculiar children. And so you see them fighting in this, as they go through this, the things that they go through, and they're fighting, they're equally, like, children, and also, so they're never superheroes, but they're like children with special abilities, and they kind of fight that way as children with special abilities. In the book, they're just like hurling in the movie, they're just like hurling snowballs and cotton candy and whatever, and it's just like, it's slapstick, as if, like, you know, the kid with the slingshot and the catapult. And it's like, well, where are their peculiar abilities? They're kind of like drowned out in the ridiculousness. And
the biggest problem, I think,
It goes from, like, peculiar children to just, like, children flinging rocks.
Special effects children.
Yeah.
And I think the biggest problem, because, again, it may sound like we're talking about surface things here, but there are no real characters to the characters, which is a problem because you don't get to know these people. There's a very interesting conceit that I won't get into that is true of the books that involves how Miss Peregrine has kept the home safe from the Hallowgast for so long. It's a pretty big element of the story of how what she is, what her peculiar ability is, ties in very closely to what they've been able to do. And that creates an interesting science fictional element to the story in the books. There's a particular element that the story points felt more like something from Doctor Who. And yet when we see them in the movie, they fall flat. Mm-hmm. The story has been reduced to almost something that doesn't make sense. And I think that's the problem here. Very rarely, now this is me having read the book and I'm watching the movie and I'm saying this thing doesn't make sense. It doesn't make emotional story sense, and it also doesn't make logical narrative sense. Let's talk about the mugging actor in the room that would be the elephant in the room, which is Samuel L. Jackson, playing a character that technically doesn't exist in the books.
I was going to say, one of the worst things about the movie isn't even in the books, and that Samuel L. Jackson's absurd
now he thing. God, it must have got a very good paycheck because he smiled through this entire movie, and he was clearly having a good time, but he's awful. He has a white fright wig, which makes his hair and Unbreakable look contained and restrained, and I love Unbreakable, but he has these white contacts on with little pinpoints in the mouth, and then he has monster teeth, like dollar store monster teeth, that he is lisping through. So he sounds like the character in The Kingsman, but not on purpose. So he's like, oh, kids, what you doing? And then there's a scene where one of them is using power and is blowing the wind in his face, and he just starts like making noise. He's like, and like shaking his face, and the wind is blowing. And it's like, this guy doesn't even, he's not even pretending like he's in a movie anymore. He's just doing stuff.
Yeah,
And I like Samuel L. Jackson usually, but this was just, it may make money, but it's not going to be a movie that people are going to really latch onto. And it almost, Burton seems to know that, because Rachel, you had spoken to this. Rachel's right. 2/3, I thought the movie was almost over because it was reaching the end point of the books. I'm like, well, this is a real disappointment. It's unfortunate they did this. But like she said, once it goes beyond the point where the first book ended, it goes completely off the rails. Which at that point, I would start blaming Ransom Riggs and say, what did you write in the second and third books? But Rachel points on, this movie goes on for another 35 minutes with not a single element from the sequels. It does its own thing.
It has a few elements, which I'm not going to, I can't touch on, which frustrates me. It has a few, like, faint, bastardized elements of the second books without sticking to the story. So it takes pieces of scenes in this book and, like, removes them from the story and makes it its own story. So by the end of the movie, I said, well, I have no idea. I guess he's not planning on doing any of the sequels because he just kind of, like, put them all in a blender and pasted them into 30 minutes. But then he leaves but then it's almost like, it is open up to go into sequels, so I'm like, well, I don't know what he's leading
There's
to.
There's a bit involving a sunken ship that is just ludicrous, that I can't imagine even exists.
No, it does. It, no.
It is. It's very disappointing. I think there may be people who enjoy this sort of thing so much that if they see special effects and fantasy, they're happy. But I don't think you're going to get many other people enjoying it. I think fans of the book, it probably wouldn't hurt to stay away from this.
A very rich quality of the book was character development.
And that's almost completely absent. That's been drained out.
It is to me, it is like not even really present.
Eva Green is totally wasted as Miss Peregrine.
And you used the term flat several times, and that's exactly what he does with the characters. He like the characters are just flattened out, ironed out, all like bits of peculiarity and uniqueness.
Nuance.
And what makes them who they are is just wiped from them. And you kind of have these blank, like, I don't know, like cardboard stand-ups.
Yeah, yeah. About the dimensionality of the big poster that sits in the lobby. It was very disappointing. And there's a few cameos. People like Judi Dench come in. And
oh,
I'm
yeah.
like, Judi Dench, why did you sign on to do this? I really couldn't understand.
I honestly think that even if I hadn't read the book, I would not have liked it.
I don't think that we would have. I think that just what is very... It wasn't even so much a slapstick. It, again, is a point to me where the story clearly wants to be darker. Because Burton does try to add this element of ghoulishness. I mean, there are some ghoulish stuff here. I would say this, too. This is a PG-13, but it's definitely... It kind of wants to be on the darker end. It's got some creepy images that probably aren't going to sit well with kids. But its tone is too goofy for anybody that wants to engage with that kind of darker story. Mm-hmm. So, big disappointment. I didn't like it at all.
I think we successfully kind of tore that apart. it was disappointing.
Critically so, though.
Yes, I found it disappointing.
All right. Well, there you have it. So, we're going to go ahead and...
You have $10 in your pocket you don't want.
That's right.
And a couple hours of just, you know...
Then go for it.
It's a nice, cool place to sleep.
Actually, you know, what's funny, you say that. Joy and I used to... this was like... 5 or 6 summers
ago. Were you movie theater hobos?
We were. We would go to the cheap theater because we were too cheap to pay for AC in our house. So like during the hot part of the day, we would take $3 at the time and go over to the cheap
That's
theater
awesome.
And pick a movie and just hang out there for 2 or 3 hours.
That's hilarious. Hope you picked good movies. I only ever did that one time. I was at school at the time. I was teaching, but I was also a student. And it was an afternoon. It was a hot afternoon, mm-hmm. like in the early summer, and I had to be somewhere in a couple hours, and I was so